All of us are looking for codes and values by which to live by, to make sense of the decisions we make, and if there's any patterns in what seems to work and what doesn't. Our guest today has a very particular perspective on this. Instead of philosophy, moral philosophy, how about thinking about humour, belief in oneself and one's own luck, and even our susceptibility to magic, how they all play a pivotal part in our lives, and if so, why? Today, we're talking to the best-selling author, Professor Richard Wiseman. He's Professor of the Public Understanding of Psychology at the University of Hertfordshire and one of the world's leading experts on why some people seem to attract opportunity while others seem to miss it. An early focus on how belief in luck can become self-fulfilling was succeeded by exploring the importance of humour as a social and psychological unblocker to recent academic research examining the impact of magic, not just on those watching it, but those practicing it. He's investigated the harms and benefits of pop psychology and examined the links between paranormal belief and psychology. He demonstrates that relatively small shifts in mindset and behaviour can transform what we think is possible, so unpacking a whole new realm of purpose and connecting with others. And in a world where many of us are reassessing what fulfillment really means at work, at home, and in our communities, his insights couldn't be more valuable. So welcome to the Weird Society, Richard.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What introduction. I mean, magic, paranormal, humour, luck, and what it means for us making sense of ourselves, a professor of the impact of psychology. This is an amazing suite of interests.
There's a lot of stuff there. I apologise for that in advance.
No, don't apologise. You're here because we think it's fascinating.
I wish I had just one thing. I don't have lots of things. So, yes, yeah, happy to talk about any of them.
Well, let's start with the magic. I mean, how did that... This is a lifelong interest, isn't it? I mean, you began...
Oh, yeah, like most magicians, I started young. So I think when I was about 8 years old, I'd go and see my grandfather, and he wasn't a magician, but he'd perform one amazing trick where he'd get me to put my initials on a coin, it would disappear, and then reappear in a box on the other side of the room. And I pestered him. I wanted to know how this was done. And like any good magician, he wouldn't tell me. And then eventually he said, the answer is in a book, and the book is in the local library. And I hated reading. I'm not a fan of reading. I don't find it at all easy. But I went along to the library, read every book I could about magic, eventually found the secret to the coin trick, went back to him. He said, you're absolutely right. And he gave me the secret something that allows that trick to happen. And it still sits in my sort of drawer.
So what is the secret something?
I can't tell you. I swore to my grandfather I would not ever pass on that secret something. Secret something is the reason why magicians hold on to their secrets. We can get into that a bit later on. But he gave me that secret something. It sits in my drawer, my office drawer. It's the most valuable object that I have in my entire house, because it was the thing that kind of led me into the world of magic. So I was convinced, if you'd spoken to me when, I guess I was 14, 15, I was doing endless shows, often kids' shows. I was convinced I wanted to be a professional magician. And then two things happened. One was I read a book, which was How to Win Friends and Influence People, the Dale Carnegie book, which is fantastic. Amazing, amazing book. Pains me to say as another self-help author, but it's absolutely brilliant. And that got me into psychology. And then I actually started working as a professional magician and decided it wasn't quite as much fun as I thought. And so I did a degree in psychology at UCL and then up at Edinburgh University. So that's my kind of pathway through.
And a professor of the impact of psychology. I mean, there are psychologists and there are social psychologists, but there's no one kind of carving out a kind of academic realm in which it's the kind of impact of all of this.
Mm.
Why that?
Well, so this is why I love the Carnegie book. It gave you tips and hints and ideas that would make a real difference in your life quite quickly. And they're very simple ideas, great ideas. When I started to study psychology, I realized that was quite rare in psychology. So humanity is amazing. You know, we fall in love and we hate one another and we argue and we behave in curious ways. And a lot of psychology simply ignores all of that. And it's really quite dull and just looks at how many numbers we can remember or whatever it is that it's looking at. So I wanted to focus on the stuff that had the potential to make a real difference to people's lives, to make a real difference to society. And I decided it was the stuff the public was probably interested in. So that's the birth of that professorship.
And Okay, so there we are. I mean, you begin this job in the early 1990s, and you're still there. I mean, you're still at the University of
Hertfordshire. I'm still there, 30-something years at the University of Hertfordshire. I joined after my PhD, which would be 92, so a long time ago. And they've been very, very kind to me, very giving, and I've stuck with it, doing these different projects. So I don't have much of an attention span. I always say that,
there's a whole kind of panoply of stuff here. Now, let's begin with luck. We make our own luck, don't we?
Yeah, the luck stuff started off because I was interviewing people about paranormal stuff, actually. And some person, and this has happened to me several times in my career, somebody says something which changes everything for you. And it happened in this one interview where I was asking somebody if they were psychic or something like that. And they said, "I'm not psychic. I'm just very lucky." And I thought, that's a really interesting idea. I said, "What do you mean?" And they said, "Well, I'm always in the right place at the right time, or I go to a party, I bump into somebody, and this person changes my life," whatever it is. And I thought, you know what? Luck is central to our lives. You look back over pretty much every culture throughout history, there's been some sense of understanding luck and trying to enhance your own good fortune. And psychologists right then, I mean, a long time ago now, hadn't really done very much work on that. And so I thought, I know, I'll give it a go. So I put all these adverts and articles in magazines and newspapers saying, if you're exceptionally lucky or unlucky, contact Richard Wiseman. We had about 1,000 people. They were our cohort of exceptionally lucky and unlucky people. And we looked at the psychological differences for about a decade between them. And it was kind of amazing that you could see that lots of the people were creating their own good and bad fortune by the way they were thinking and behaving. And they didn't realize it. To them, it just looked magical. But when you looked at it in a particularly psychological way, you could see some of the strategies that they were using. And that became the basis of the work.
Well, come on. I mean, that's tantalizing. We need. So what are the strategies? What are those strategies?
I think with a lot of the lucky people, there was a kind of openness. They knew their goal. They knew where they were heading. They just weren't certain how they were going to get there. And so they were very flexible people. They kind of would think, okay, the wind's not blowing in this direction. I'm not going to go this way. I'm going to go that way. So they're very open. And in fact, a colleague of mine has done work on flexibility. And simple things like trying different sorts of restaurants or rearranging your furniture or watching TV programs you don't normally watch, all those things induce that sense of flexibility, of not having a single plan. You have a goal, but not a plan. And they had that big time, and that mattered to them. They're also open to opportunities. And so we did an experiment, which has now become actually quite a well-known experiment, where we asked them to flick through the pages of a newspaper and count the number of pictures or photographs in the newspaper. Pretty dull, 1, 2, 3, 4. What we didn't tell them is there were two opportunities in the newspaper, half-page adverts. One of them said, "Stop counting the pictures. There are 58 of them in the newspaper." The other said, "Tell the experimenter you've seen this and win £1,000. And the unlucky people, who are very focused, went straight past these huge opportunities. The lucky people would stop and go, "Oh my goodness, that's great. Do I get the money?" I would explain it's just an experiment. They weren't that lucky. So there is this kind of openness, this expansiveness to their worldview that I think drives it. So that's one. Second, they tend to be very intuitive people. The unlucky people didn't have that sense of intuition, and they were certainly very scared of trusting it. They just tended to be stuck in a rut. Third, as you might imagine, the lucky people are very confident the future was going to be bright. The unlucky people convinced it was going to be dreadful. And fourth, and this is one that really mattered, and it's become a huge topic since, is resilience. Yeah. The lucky people were astonishingly resilient. Whatever happened to them, they bounce back. So I can remember there was one lucky guy that came in, I think it was second or third interview. He'd fallen down the stairs in between, broken his leg. And I said, "Oh, presumably you don't think you're quite so lucky." And he said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You never know." He said, "Last time I got ill, went to hospital, met a nurse, fell in love, the most amazing thing that ever happened to me." There was one unlucky person, multi-millionaire, because he'd won the lottery, hit the jackpot. £3 million it was. And I said, "You consider yourself unlucky?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "The same time I chose my numbers, somebody else chose the same numbers. I had to share a £6 million jackpot." How unlucky is that? So you could see these factors bubbling up, and it never occurred to them.
So come on, we've got to, you know, you're a self-help man. I mean, our listeners will be charmed and intrigued by what you're saying, and they might be thinking, how can I get some of that? How can I rewire myself to be kind of open and flexible and therefore luckier?
So it's a great question. To you, it's a very obvious question. To psychologists, that's a really contentious thing, because some of them will go, you know what? Your genes make your brain. The brain makes you. There's not much room for change in there. You can pick any psychological factor at all, intelligence, personality, whatever you want, how lucky you are. A lot of it will be down to your brain, your genes, and so on, and therefore unchangeable. As a social psychologist, I have no interest in that at all. What I am interested in is the bit you can change. And so we had a series of interventions called Luck School, where we tested these things. We went out and we said to...
Luck School.
Luck School is what we called the series of experiments.
I love all this. It's great.
So we went out to people. We said, try this intervention for a couple of weeks, see if it makes you feel luckier. And we could hone some of those interventions down. And it was always the simple stuff. I mean, again, psychologists, particularly for a Freudian, would tell you, you know, change takes many, many years. We weren't into that. We wanted a change within a couple of weeks. And so if you take the simplest one, which has now become a very big area of psychology, which is the psychology of gratitude. If before you go to sleep, you jot down, and you do have to write it down, it doesn't work if you just think about it, three positive things that you'll have a sense of gratitude for in your life, your health, your friends, your job, or something great that's happened over the last 24 hours, or something bad that used to happen that doesn't happen anymore.
Thankfulness.
Thankfulness would be, yeah, another word for it. That builds up this body of evidence that you can't ignore over a couple of weeks. And people start to shift their perception into a luckier person because, my goodness, look at all these amazing things. And when that happens, they start to change how they behave. And one of the things is that when we're a bit more optimistic about the future, people like being around us. And those people provide us with opportunities and help us when we encounter difficulties.
Yep.
The unlucky people tended to be socially isolated, and they didn't have that network of friends because they weren't much fun to be around, and terrible things had happened to them, and so on. So managing to do these very small changes, which then made a very big impact, became part of the work that excited me.
So the We Society recommends a bit of thankfulness on a daily basis.
Absolutely. Write it down. Write it down, though, because it's then that you build up this body of work. You look back at this notebook and go, my goodness, look at all these amazing things.
If you're looking for depth and perspective on American democracy right now, I'd strongly recommend Last Best Hope, hosted by Adam Smith, Professor of American Political History and Director of the Rothermere American Institute at Oxford. Each episode is story-filled, rigorous, and packed with insight. The new series opens with an interview with Hillary Clinton, reflecting on America and its place in the world. And later episodes ask some timely questions, such as whether states' rights should now become the battle cry of progressives. And with this year marking the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, they've got a special two-part documentary exploring why the authors chose to write it in the way they did, and why that still matters. Search for The Last Best Hope and follow it now on all good podcast platforms. Now let's move on. I mean, there was a period then in which, you know, that was a rich seam, and then you diverted into humour. It wasn't long, I know, but you were interested in the idea of what makes us laugh.
Yeah, I've always, but I think that's probably more related to the magic. We'll come back to that in a second. Let me just talk about the little next step on the luck stuff. So I did the luck work, and then I go out for a coffee with a CEO friend of mine, and she says...
Is all this noted down? I hope you've noted all this down.
It's all noted down. It's in notebook. It's a very positive thing. She said, look, I'm in charge of this big organization, but we've been friends for many years. I'm not very happy. What can you tell me to do to become happier? And I started to talk about psychology of happiness. And she looked at her watch and she says, can you get on with it? Because I'm quite busy. And I said, how long have you got? And she said, about a minute. And that conversation, that moment, a bit like talking to the person about psychic versus luck, changed everything. I walked away. I thought, what can you tell people in a minute that makes some sort of difference to their life? And that became the basis for the next book, which is 59 Seconds, Things You Can Learn in Less Than a Minute. And again, I think we don't see these opportunities. Often we just kind of go through life. It'd have been really easy to just park that conversation, walked away and carried on working on whatever book I was working on. Instead of going, no, there was something there. Let's change direction because that's now interesting. And so that became 59 seconds, and which are all sort of things to do with motivation or persuasion you could learn quickly. So I think it is that openness to change that fascinates me. Sorry,
come on. Yeah. I mean, every building block and every answer gets us a little bit further down the road here. What makes us laugh? I mean, there's some. Mm. I was looking at some of the jokes that, and the world's most famous joke and the best joke. Yeah, there's some great jokes. Some great jokes.
We should talk. Yeah, so the basis of that project.
Tell the world's greatest joke.
I'm not going to tell the world's greatest joke. It's online. It's awful.
It's a fun joke.
It's okay joke.
It's the one where.
Yeah, I know, with the hunters.
The hunters and one sister. Come on.
I'm not going to tell you the joke. It's not a great joke.
Right. Well, I think it's a good one.
It's two hunters out in the woods. One falls over, is laying motionless on the ground. The other one panics, takes out their mobile phone, phones emergency services and says, my goodness, my friend's laying motionless. And the person in emergency services says, look, calm down. First of all, we have to make certain they're dead. And there's a pause and a gunshot. And the person comes back on the line and says, right, I've done that. Now what?
I should laugh, but it is. It is ridiculous.
That's the biggest response he's ever got in about 20 years of telling it. So that won our competition, but we should explain. So basically, it was the British Association.
Now, what's wrong or right with me that I laughed at that?
Well, you're very kind and very giving.
Perhaps there'll be something. He dared to laugh at a joke like that. That's a rather dark thing to laugh at.
Well, it's the world's funniest joke, so I think you're allowed to laugh at it.
Okay.
So that came about because the British Association for the Advancement of Science, they were then, wanted a year-long experiment to get people interested in science. And I did this thing, which I often do, which is when I go into ideas meetings, I know what they're after. I know the brief, but I have no answer. I hope the answer will come to me as I step through the doorway into the meeting. Often it doesn't, and it's just embarrassing. But in that moment, it did. I stepped into the room. There's a panel there. I said, we're going to search for the world's funniest joke. And they said, done, sold. That's it. That's the experiment. I had no idea how we're going to do it, what it would mean or anything. Went back to the team. So we're going to search the world's funniest joke. They went, great. What's that mean? I said, I've got no idea. And we eventually decided to collect information on the internet, which was a radical idea at that point. We designed a website where people could submit their favourite jokes and rate the jokes submitted by others. And we ran it for a year. And people sent in all their jokes. We found out very early on that some of those jokes were a little bit rude. Actually, a lot of them were filthy. And so I had to employ somebody full-time to go through the jokes of the previous 24 hours and take out the really dirty ones. And they've got an amazing collection of absolutely filthy jokes. And then we allowed the others through and we could look at the ratings, and the hunter joke won after a year.
And what do you conclude from this? There's something there, isn't there? I mean, I think it's kind of, in part of your work, one of your books, you make a reference, not just to kind of openness and all the rest of it, but actually a sense of humour.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's true in the world of work. It's true everywhere. And we are drawn to them. And that, I suppose, makes them, because we're drawn to them, that's part of the network they create. And then they get luckier. And
absolutely. I mean, it's been humour has been referred to as the shortest distance between two people. You know, it is a lovely idea if you can make somebody laugh. To me, it's the most lovely sound in the world. As a magician, when I'm performing, to make a few hundred people laugh, I care about that more than I care about, oh my goodness, that's an incredible trick.
I like making people laugh. I really enjoy
laugh,
it. If I can find a joke,
then
I look for it.
Yes,
yeah,
it's great and it's warm and it's bonding people together, or the right sort of humour is bonding people together. Also, it's misdirection. It takes people's minds off of something while you're laughing at something else. And some of the time, we take topics which make us feel very stressed and anxious and worried, and we use jokes to reduce the worry about that.
While you're talking, I've got to ask you this. I've been struck recently, and a sad Christmas Day night, but I found myself watching a whole series of Morecambe and Wise Christmas shows, and I thought how very, very funny they were.
Yeah.
And I thought, and there's a whole kind of generation of comedians and comedians, actually, but many comedians, who really kind of, Tommy Cooper, Max Bygraves, I mean, there's kind of endless Dick Emery, very, very funny. And it seems to have kind of were much less well endowed with public humour.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think what's...
Am I wrong on that? I don't know. Am I guilty of thinking of a golden age? Or
I think with Morecambe and Wise, they have aged very well. I mean, unlike many of their contemporaries,
where we go,
oh my goodness, so we can't be saying that anymore, or laughing at that. You could, I think, pretty much look at any Morecambe and Wise show and it plays well now. And it's because they've got a very special relationship between one another and we love them. And the material is extremely good. So I think that's always been there. And the generation now will be laughing at stuff that we might not find so funny because it's a different set of markers and so on. But I think humour is very important at bonding people together. It can be used in quite a vicious way as well. It can be used in quite a bullying way.
Yeah.
There's a lovely Mel Brooks comment, which he said as a performer, his job is to make the audience, to bring out the best in them, to make this audience the best they can be as individuals. And he always tells jokes which do that, that bond people together. He says it's easy for him to come out, pick on somebody in the front row and turn the audience into a bunch of bullies. That's not what the gig is.
It was such a great line, wasn't it, from Eric Morecambe, a famous Audrey Brevin sketch. I'm playing all the right notes, but not necessarily in the right order. And actually, you laugh at it, but there's a kind of, it does do just what you've described. So you do all that.
I should say it's a great Des O'Connor line, because they allegedly hated Des O'Connor, which was, Des O'Connor is a difficult man to ignore, but it's well worth the effort.
You guys. Now look, we then get into magic. And this, of course, you were saying earlier, for 8-year-old with your grandfather and the disappearing coin. Obviously, you're preoccupied in a personal sense. Mm. But actually, I'm not struggling, but I'm looking forward to hearing how you link that with the impact of psychology, which is your professorial role.
Yeah. So that's only been the last few years. So magic is basically my life. All of my closest friends are magicians. I invent magic for magicians. I advise on them and perform shows and so on. It occurred to me at some point that you are learning all sorts of skills as a magician. One of them is obviously confidence. Another is the ability to lie and deceive people whilst actually hopefully being quite likable. Also, you have to practice, so there's self-regulation and focus in there. Then you have to remember all of this stuff in the right order, a bit like the notes on Eric and Ernie, cope with failure, tricks frequently fail. And then all of these life skills, I think that myself and my friends have all learned through magic. And I don't think any of us realize it, but that's what we've all learned. So I thought, why not take magic and use it as a vehicle with kids to try and develop some of those life skills? And so that's what we've been doing, teaching tricks, where you go, it's not really about the tricks, it's about all of these other amazing life skills. And the big thing about magic is that if you're going to be a successful magician or any sort of performer, you've got to think about the audience. You've got to think about, not am I enjoying this, are they enjoying it?
Now, that's persuasive, but is there any evidence to back it up?
None at all. Yes, there is. Yes. So we've we've collected some of it. We looked at creativity and magic. So what's interesting about magical thinking is you, first of all, come up with something that's impossible and you're open to that idea. So if I'm sitting around, in fact, I have been this morning with a group of magicians, and one of them says, look, got to make this table levitate. We don't go, oh my God, what are you talking about? Tables don't levitate. You're wasting your time. We don't do that. We go, well, have you tried this or have you tried that? In other words, you take something seemingly impossible and you start to think about ways in which you can achieve it. And that's a phenomenal life skill. And then in order to think of those ways, you have to be quite creative about lateral thinking and so on. Is the table as heavy as it appears and all this sort of stuff. And with kids, when we taught them very simple magic tricks, you saw a big rise in creative thinking. They started to imagine how impossible things might be possible and how you'd go about doing that. Much more than, for example, art class or anything like this. So we started to try and add in some of that psychological methodology to underpin what we're doing.
So the national curriculum should have a bit of magic every
year. It should
year.
Only be magic. It should, okay. It should just be magic. You learn about maths. You've got to read about it. Writing instructions to magic tricks, horrendous, because you have to think, you know, what does the person know? Or what do they need to know at this point? And so on. It's a really good exercise for literacy. So I think you can pretty much teach anything through magic, and kids love it. It's fun.
Now, this is an amazing panorama of interests and actually insights, but let's kind of try and pull it together. I mean,
good luck. I've been trying to do that for 30 years.
Well, we're going to try in the next 5 minutes.
Go for it. Go for it.
I mean, I'm often asked, or I sometimes volunteer the view, that actually what makes a person happy is actually, you know, there's minimum requirements, roof over your head, food in your stomach, that kind of person to love, health. But that's not fundamental. What's fundamental is acting on the world in some way, using the gifts, as Aristotle would have said, that the gods have given you to make the world incrementally better. Do you agree with that?
I would. What would I say? What I say to younger people now when I talk to them is that they will have a passion. My passion, I found early on in life, was magic. But they'll have some sort of passion, the thing that puts fire in their eyes, gets them up in the morning, gets them very excited about the world. If they figure out a way of earning a living involving that passion, they'll probably be on the route to happiness.
Which is a kind of, so you would say, and passion and purpose are kind of interrelated in a way.
I think the purpose, I would say, is always find a way of contributing to something which is bigger than yourself.
Yep.
So I'm going to go back to magic again because that's my thing. Magic has a huge literature like science, like law, medicine, that stretches back. Every magician can make a contribution to the art form in one way or another. They can contribute because we are only the custodians for this generation. And the previous generation suffered to give us what we've got, and it's our job to pass it on to the next lot in a hopefully better and more interesting shape than we inherited it. And I think that, as a kind of way of looking at the world, is not a terrible way. People suffered so that we've got what we've got, and we pass it on, hopefully improved, to the next group of people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that gives you that sense of purpose.
And what about that group of social psychologists who've argued that the source of well-being is to live somewhere aesthetically beautiful and have access to, ready access to nature, and that fills you with well-being?
Yeah, it doesn't for me.
Great.
It fills me with horror. First of all, a lot of people haven't got access to that. I think you can be creative and you can make those sorts of contributions anywhere. And that's what's so exciting about it. You don't need to be wandering through the woods to have a creative thought. I might have one, you know, on the way to here today or on the way back or when I wake up tomorrow morning. And normally it is when I wake up. That's when I have most sort of creative ideas.
Yeah, I find that, yeah.
So I think your brain's been working away overnight suddenly go, oh my goodness, why don't we just rearrange all the pieces? Now the picture's much more interesting. I don't need to be wandering through a forest. I rarely have good ideas wandering through a forest. I normally just get a little bit bored because I'm away from my books and I quite like them.
Now, Richard, I've got to pull you. I want you to round this all off. I mean, if you had a sentence with which to kind of leave our listeners, kind of pulling all this together, and you're a self-help man. I mean, you like to help people live better. You've got a sentence or two for them to sign off on this We Society podcast. Come on.
I would say that we're really good at habituating to whatever situation we find ourselves in. And that's both good and bad. So whatever is happening to you right now, it will change. If you're not in a great place, it'll get better. Believe me, things will change and it'll probably get better. Equally, if you're enjoying life, enjoy it now. Enjoy it. Live in the moment because it'll probably get worse in the future. So either way, change will happen. What makes us the most interesting creatures in the entire universe is that we change. Life alters. It evolves over time, over our lifetimes. And that if you realize that when you're in a bad place, it's going to get better. If you're in a good place, enjoy it because that's going to change as well. I think that's fundamental to what I've been doing.
How interesting. My mother used to tell me, nothing's ever as good or as bad as you think it's going to be. Just keep steady, you know. You're just going to weigh what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, the old adage, you know, if you're going through hell, keep going. I think that's true. And that's what fascinates me about us. I'm not really interested, and so many psychologists are, in this idea that we don't show, let's look at our genes, let's look at our brain. I'm not interested. I'm interested in giving people the tools that allow them to change in a positive way, to add purpose to their lives, to help other people, sometimes to help themselves, to help society, to build a better society. That's what psychology should be. It isn't, always like that, but when it's at its best, that is what psychology should be.
Professor Richard Wiseman, thank you so much. A really interesting conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.